reserving functions talking to the other actuaries. This side of the room is one sort of actuary for illustrative purposes, and these are the other actuaries. Shake hands at your leisure. We have two speakers today. We're going to start with Mike McKnight on my right here. Mike is the chief actuary of reinsurance for Max Capital Group. Previously, Mike served in various actuarial and underwriting capacities, including structured risk underwriter for Catlin Insurance Company in Bermuda, and chief underwriting officer for Girling Global International Reinsurance in Barbados. He also spent 7 years with the actuarial firm Milliman, where he worked in the Atlanta office, and then the London office, and finally running the Bermuda practice. So we chased him further and further south. Mike received a BS in applied mathematics from Valdosta State University. He's an associate of the Casualty Actuarial Society and a member of the American Academy. Mike?
Good afternoon. When we were talking about this session originally, about setting it up, we did think that there's often two groups of actuaries in many companies. There's often pricing actuaries and reserving actuaries. And there's often not communication. And it does seem like both sets of actuaries think the other set's a little strange. And I think the splitting hairs a little bit. What we probably can agree on, it's the life actuaries that are very strange. From my perspective, I've always found the sessions that are most useful are the ones where the actuary that works at a company is coming up to talk about what he does or she does at that specific company. They're talking about the day in and day out problems they see. And that's the way we've organized this session, is just to talk about what we do at our companies, with not much speculating about what's going on at other companies, but specifically what we're doing at our company. My presentation, I'm going to first go through and give some personal observations of a few other companies just to put it in perspective of what we do at Max. I'm going to go through the background and approach of how we handle the integration of actuarial functions at Max, the flow of information between the different actuaries, between the pricing actuaries and the reserving actuaries, and then I'm going to expand a little bit into how the actuaries communicate with the other departments within the company, the claims department, the finance department, and the underwriters. And I'll wrap up with a few odds and ends, just some comments, and then open it up for any questions. Let me ask, are there many people from a reinsurance company in here? Okay, we got a few people. It seems like most of you are going to be from the primary companies. Just as a matter of background, my perspective is going to be from reinsurance. Mark's going to speak from an insurance perspective. It does seem that every reinsurance company has a slightly different approach to how they're handling their pricing and their reserving functions. And some examples I've seen include some insular functions where the pricing actuaries and reserving actuaries don't really even speak to each other. They may be located in different buildings, or on different floors, or sometimes in different countries. I've also seen instances where it's very small. Companies where the reserving and pricing are done by the same people, same actuaries are handling both pricing and reserving work. I've seen cases where the reserving is done only on an annual basis. At the end of the year, they wrap up and look back and see how they've done. And I've seen cases where the reserving is done exclusively by external actuaries. In Bermuda, where our operations are located, any actuary working on the pricing cannot be the one that issues the loss reserve certificate, cannot certify the reserve. So if you're an actuary and you somehow work with underwriters or the pricing, the Bermuda Monetary Authority does not want you to be the one certifying the reserves. They think it's a conflict of interest there. So a lot of companies that are very small will just have an external actuaries come in and set up the reserves at the end of the year. I have seen some situations where the reserving department unilaterally sets up the capital requirements for each deal, as well as selecting the ultimate loss ratio on each deal. And this is often important from an underwriting perspective because that determines how profitable their contracts and their business unit is. So the reserving department will come in and say, before you write this, let me let you know, we're going to set up this much capital on the particular contract, and we're going to assign a particular loss ratio. And that may be completely independent of what the pricing actuaries are going to do. We don't really do any of those approaches at Max. It's been an evolution. I've been at the company for now about 5 years, and it's changed a lot over those last 5 years. When I first started the company, it was still pretty much in startup mode. They didn't have a chief actuary, and they had no actuaries within the company that were doing any reserving work. We had about a dozen different actuaries, but they were all involved in the pricing of the products. I got to emphasize that the approach we take is based on actuarial science and not rocket science. It's whether we're doing reserving or pricing, we like to know the underlying coverage. We like to look at the historical experience of the contract. We like to use standard pricing and reserving techniques. Nothing too much out of the ordinary. We do focus a lot on claim counts, looking at the number of claims that we expect to be generated from a particular contract. We have to have constant communication between the pricing actuaries and the reserving actuaries. And this goes on every single day. We sit actually in different locations within the company. We're on different floors. We do have some of our pricing actuaries in a different country, in fact. But it requires us to sit down face-to-face often, or be on the phone, or send emails back and forth. All the analysis is performed on a contract-by-contract basis. Of course, we're going to price every contract individually, but when it comes to reserving, we're also going to reserve every contract individually. We're going to look at the particular experience of it. We're going to compare it to the renewals on contracts that are renewing to see how that is performing. And we're going to strive for consistency and accountability. We're going to see consistency pretty much in our reserving approaches. We see a lot of inconsistency, though, in the pricing, depending on what line of business it is. And that's because certain methods are more applicable for, say, excess workers' comp that wouldn't be applicable necessarily for excess aviation or satellite insurance. I will say that Max has insurance and reinsurance operations, and what I'm going to describe here is just strictly our reinsurance operations. We write a lot of different lines of business. We write workers' comp, property catastrophe, and per risk. We do medical malpractice. We also write professional liability, other types of professional liability, some E&O for accountants. We do a little D&O book. We actually made the decision to cut back on our D&O exposure a couple of years ago. That's worked out pretty well. Do some aviation and satellite, energy and marine. We've got a small heterogeneous general casualty book of business. We've recently gone into agriculture, and we write a whole account book of business that's predominantly London market-based. Most of our business is excess of loss. We do a little bit of quota share. We do a little bit of aggregate stop loss. We don't do any financial guarantee or credit. We don't do any surety. And we don't write any loss portfolio transfers. So these days, our book of business is a pretty traditional book of business, all prospective, and predominantly excess of loss. Our annual volume for the reinsurance is approximately $500 million for the P&C, and we write about 750 different contracts. That number looks a little high. We actually write, we can write many contracts for the same cedent. If we're writing an excess of loss book of business, we may write the first $1 million, and that's a contract. The second $1 million above that is also a separate contract, and so on. So what we may see with 750 contracts is that there are only about 250 different cedents underlying this book of business. This is the way our actuarial functions are sort of divided. We have the corporate actuarial area, that's my area, and the chief actuary is in that, and that's home to our reserving. Then we have the pricing actuaries that actually are in the different business units. Some of our pricing actuaries are also underwriters, so they're definitely in the business units. They don't report up to the chief actuary. They're going to report into the heads of the chief underwriting officers of the different companies. Our feedback loop can sort of be described by this schematic. The submission information comes in. The pricing actuaries are going to evaluate it. They're going to follow up with a few questions. And they're going to do their analysis. And then they're going to pass it over to the chief actuary for final review. And this is the one part where I'm getting involved in the pricing, is I do the reviews, looking for consistency, looking for profitability, measures, and I'm going to give them the feedback. I'm also going to be looking at information from our finance department and our claims department, and occasionally I'll go back to the submission information myself. What I'm going to be doing is on renewals, I'm going to give them my estimate of how the past contracts have performed. So it's a very basic approach taken by the pricing actuaries. They're going to take that submission information, they're going to create what we call a pricing model. It's basically what is the expected loss cost from the different contracts. And they're also going to look for variance. What do they think the variance is around that loss cost? They're going to take that information and then put it into an ROE model, a return on equity model. I don't know if everybody's familiar with that. It's a fairly standard technique in the reinsurance area. We're going to look at a stochastic approach to see what the different outcomes of our different contracts could be. And that's because many contracts have other loss mitigating factors. They may have loss corridors, annual aggregate deductibles. They may be swing rated or have reinstatement premiums. And they could have sliding ceding commissions associated with them as well. So there's other variables that need to be considered when we're pricing the contracts. So they'll take their loss pick and the variance, simulate about 10,000 simulations with the contract features overlaid to see what the potential outcome of the contracts are. And from that, we look at our return on equity and what is our expected combined ratio. These are the models I review. I review the pricing models and I review the ROE models, again, looking for consistency and appropriateness of the methods. It's a fairly quick process that I do to review these, and it's mainly because the number of contracts we're looking at is so large. Furthermore, as you can imagine, a lot of the contracts are written at the first of the year on 1-1 or 4-1, so there's a lot of contracts coming through. I need to get a really quick turnaround time for them. The underwriters are waiting to get a submission out, to get a quote out, so we need to get back to them pretty quick. So what I focus in on is just a high-level review of the contracts. What are they making their assumptions? What are the key assumptions? I capture a lot of key statistics that go into a database so that I compare what they priced it at versus what it's coming out at later on, a few years down the road. And I'm looking for consistency with prior projections. Are they using the same methods? Are they giving the same weight to the methods? Is there any fundamental change from last year to this year? And of course, when we get to new deals, especially new types of deals, we expand the discussions. And we'll often start these weeks in advance, especially as we go into a new line of business. So as far as the flow of information goes, the pricing actuaries are providing me with the expected loss ratios. They're giving me a stochastic range of loss ratios, actually combined ratios. They're giving me support on their loss pick. And occasionally they'll give me loss development patterns or severity distributions that may take the form of increased limits factors or excess loss factors for workers' comp. And they'll often give me frequency statistics on how many claims they think are going to be coming into the contract. We very much like to focus for many of our lines of business on the claim counts. You got to imagine that some of our excess of loss contracts are only going to produce one, two, maybe a dozen claims a year. So that's a very relevant statistic to know. It's just how many claims are you projecting? Sometimes we've had pricing actuaries say, I expect this book to run at an 80% combined ratio. And then when you dig underneath it, you realize they're expecting about one claim every 3 years. So I think this contract is going to probably run at either a zero loss ratio or 180% loss ratio. And I think you get a little bit too specific when you say it's an 80% loss ratio plus or minus 10 points. So that's a case where I don't think they're actually in a situation like that looking at the variance in the same way I would be looking at it. And that's very much conveyed by the number of claims. Conversely, the amount of, the information I'm giving back to them is actually the case incurred information on renewal contracts. I'm telling them how these contracts have been performed from a case incurred basis. I'm also giving them my projection of ultimate loss based on the loss experience and my projection of the ultimate premiums or ultimate acquisition cost, again, based on the contract features. And this is from just the contracts that are being renewed. I'm going to give them reports that aggregate all this experience by line of business, by underwriting year, and by underwriter, and a few other categories. And occasionally I'll give them the development patterns if they need to supplement their analysis with some industry development patterns. We've collected a database of over 600 different sets of development patterns, so we have a pretty extensive list that we can give them to help in the pricing process. I also will give them our severity analysis, what we think the number of claims is likely to be, as well as some possible severity distributions. Now, to measure success, we actually go back after the contract is run for a while, and we know what we're projecting the ultimate loss to be, and we compare that with the stochastic outcome or that was produced at the time of pricing. And this is an actual contract, the range of stochastic outcomes that are possible from an excess of loss contract. It's one where there was not a lot of claims to be associated with it, so the possibility of zero claims was actually a pretty measurable amount. These are combined ratios, so what we're seeing is a spike at the beginning, and that represents zero claims, or no claims being reported, but there's always an acquisition cost associated with the contract. And then it takes on a typical, fairly skewed distribution. We're not expecting the pricing actuary to get it right. What we're looking for is some sort of bias coming from any given pricing actuary. Are their estimates typically coming up in the upper 50th percentile or the lower 50th percentile? Is the way the contract performing actually something that was contemplated? And we have had a few contracts that ran at such high levels that that was not actually contemplated at the time of pricing. It's a very rare event, but we want to make sure that we're being honest with ourselves. And so we're looking again for any bias from actuary to actuary. The way we measure the success of the reserving department is on an approach you've probably seen. It's the path of the ultimate loss ratio. We're simply looking to see how much the estimates are changing from one evaluation to the next on a closed group of contracts. Here's two different lines of business, and this is how the loss ratios have changed on these lines of business over a specific period from one evaluation to the next. And we go back to see why our estimates are changing, what's the cause for it. That top line, for example, this is actual experience, and we had a double counting of some claims in our claim system that led to a decrease almost right off the bat that once that error was corrected. And then since then, it's sort of tracked down. Both of them had tracked down just a minor amount, but this is how we evaluate our performance. It's like you'd always do, a retrospective test of reserves. As far as interacting with other departments, we do have to deal with underwriting departments, claims departments, finance, management, and I believe the keys to success are going to be the constant communication. We spend a lot of time talking with our finance department to make sure that they get the correct amounts booked. We spend a lot of time from the reserving department talking with our underwriters just to understand the contracts that they're writing, understand the tort reform in the different states, what are their concerns. And we spend a tremendous amount of time talking with our claims department. What are they seeing in terms of claims? How are they coding the various claims? Do they have any information about the coverage on different claims? Are there any disputes going on? And I think, again, one of the keys is going to be understanding the other person's perspective and also understanding their needs and timelines. So when we're working with the finance department and we need to get them the information to get it into our financials on a timely basis, we're talking with them about what's the deadlines, how often do you need it, what level of detail do you need to get these amounts in? And at the same time, you need to respect their experience and their opinion. Everybody's coming at this from a different perspective. Our accountants are coming at it slightly different from our underwriters, and definitely somewhat different from our claims people as well. We're also looking for consistency. We believe that's very key, as we're consistently telling them the information in the same format, not changing it up every quarter. Also, we look for documentation. This is very key, I think, for us and for myself also, to have documentation that supports the position that we're taking, whether it's a reserve position or what we think about a particular line from a pricing perspective. If it's documented clearly, it's going to be good for you in the end run when you can come back and see exactly what your thought process was. And it makes it very easy when you're dealing with external actuaries or the auditors. The pricing actuaries have to interact almost exclusively with our underwriters. And like I said, some of our pricing actuaries are actually the underwriters themselves. They then have to interact with the corporate actuarial area to some degree. The corporate actuarial area, as I mentioned, we have to deal with the underwriters, the pricing actuaries. We have to work with the finance department. We have to work with the claims department. And both departments work with the management of the company. I did want to talk just a minute about documentation. I think this is very key in the analysis of any reserving analysis, that you document it adequately so you understand what were the assumptions you made and that anybody reviewing your work can know exactly what's included and not included. I do like to follow, as an internal company actuary, I came with from a consulting background, and I really do like to follow the same process that our consulting actuaries do, or what I did when I was a consulting actuary. And that means I do follow the standards of practice on actuarial communications, and especially the one on property and casualty unpaid claim estimates. We do put together a quarterly reserve study, and it's going to look just pretty much like an external study. It'll give a scope, limitations, the different methods that we are using, the data quality, any changes to the claims handling. So that's all going into a quarterly reserve study that can be handed outside to our regulators or external actuaries, and then they can look at that. It's a very self-contained document. And it also gives a history of what you've been doing on the book of business. I did want to wrap up with just a few odds and ends. Working with external and auditing actuaries, and this is something that we put a lot of effort into with our both our external and auditing actuaries. We start the process with our external actuaries in September when they come in to do it. They're going to come in and do a year-end reserve study. So we like to keep touch with them throughout the year, but then starting in about September, really start to ramp up for the year-end work. We like to be extremely responsive to their needs and anticipating what they're going to need. Likewise, with our auditing actuaries, we like to be very responsive, and our goal is to get them answers within 24 hours of them asking us a question, and it's always in a documented form. It's a memo to them. It's got supporting exhibits, but we, again, they have a very tough job. We're a big company, changed a lot over the last few years. We really want to document and give them good support so that they can reach similar conclusions, or hopefully audit our conclusions and they're similar to ours. Also, I like to have I can't emphasize the need for a plan. When I started with my company about 5 years ago, there was no reserving department. We were still in startup mode. We'd written a lot of long-tailed contracts. Of course, we'd had the external reviews done every year end, but we really hadn't done anything internally. And I had a plan about how I wanted to get all our hundreds of contracts analyzed every quarter going forward. And it took a plan that took many years to implement, but that's the thing that kept me going throughout this, was just to know where we were going to go with this process. And we still have a plan on how to make this process better, how to improve what we think will improve our estimates. And then we start out every week with a meeting that just expands upon this plan and breaks it down into little bits. I don't know if the last comment in any way sounds like an oxymoron, but I do think you always have to be true to your professional ethics. And I think an example of being flexible but not compromising goes back to when I first started at the company. I wanted to get a reserve study out just as soon as possible, but knew that I couldn't really adequately address all the hundreds of contracts we had written up to that time. And as opposed to putting out a study that sort of really quickly gave a very quick impression of the first contracts, I selected the largest contracts and did in-depth analysis, and every quarter expanded that study until we reached 100% coverage. So I was able to put out some very useful information that covered a large percentage of our reserves, but at the same time made sure that the product I was providing was thorough, and I've done the proper research and was very happy with the quality of the product. So that's our approach from a reinsurance perspective. You want to wait for questions?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know if anybody has any questions from a reinsurance perspective.
I noticed
earlier, there were a few reinsurance actuaries. Do you have similar approaches to what Mike described, or anything materially different that you might do that you'd care to share with us?
I think you're going to have to ask them specifically.
Okay, thanks, Mike. Okay, next we have Mark Phillips, and Mark's a local boy, was born in Poluap, Washington. Is there anyone from Seattle around here? Ever heard of this place? Have you? And how do you say it? Yeah, see, he sandbagged me. Okay. All right. Mark graduated from Pacific Lutheran University, which is in Tacoma. He's a fellow of the CAS and a member of the American Academy. He started his career with United Pacific and has worked for several other companies. He wanted me to mention Coopers & Lybrand in particular. Has lived in a variety of very scenic places, obviously started in Washington, lived in California, Texas, Ohio, and now Georgia, until they run him out of there, I guess. And he currently works for American Safety Insurance Group in Atlanta, Georgia. He's a member of the Committee on Professionalism Education, and they're having a presentation tomorrow. So if you like him today, you're going to love him tomorrow. If you don't like him today, give him another chance and come back tomorrow. Mark.
Well, thank you. I just wanted to kind of add a little bit here on the name of Puyallup. The joke about that is actually, any of you guys remember Johnny Carson? You know, those of us that are a little older had watched him, right? Every year, the city of Puyallup has an annual daffodil festival, and they would always send him a full backdrop of daffodils. And every year, he would try to pronounce the city and would pronounce it differently each and every time. So
you didn't do too bad.
We'll start off with what I call the blame game. When they asked me about the integration of pricing and reserving, I actually had some experience in various companies I worked at with one of the whole issues of, you know, different actuaries coming into management with different loss ratios. And typically when you find that you have these big discrepancies, you also find that maybe there were some definitional issues. And we'll get back to some of those later. Basically, I start off the blame game with reserving actuaries having to go to management with prior year emergence and basically saying, you know, this is an indication maybe the pricing actuary is drinking a little too much Kool-Aid with the underwriters and got too optimistic. And the pricing actuaries look at it and say, well, that's okay, but I got to look at my current pricing today. That really doesn't matter if we made a mistake back then. We corrected it. We move ahead. And management sits there and has to kind of judge the whole scenario and often is wondering why in the world do these guys use the same data and come up with completely different answers. Anyways, with that, I want to kind of have a little agenda here going through a little bit of my company background at ASI, which is an excess and surplus lines writer. Explain a little bit about our small actuarial department and a little bit of the differences and focuses we have between the reserving and pricing side. We'll talk a little bit about the differences in the data that we will typically use for our studies, the interdependencies, and then beyond the others, where I kind of talk a little bit about, you know, the reporting structure and who our audience is. Okay. ASI is a small hopefully soon to be medium-sized excess and surplus lines carrier. Right now, about $250 million of premium. Mostly, almost entirely casualty business, just a little bit of surety, a little bit of property at this point. So those of you who aren't into the excess and surplus lines field, one of the advantages to it is that we don't have typical filing requirements for rate, rule, and form. Pretty much allowed to do whatever we need to do to get the business out. So don't have to necessarily sit apart, you know, on top of a statutory filing department as well as doing actuarial work. At ASI, we specialize in placing what we consider to be difficult risks. Our number one line, and the one the company's probably most known for, is the environmental contractors. Our company originally started as an RRG for a bunch of environmental contractors, and then have grown into a typical E&S structure, and we actually have operations in Bermuda as well. We do nursing homes and contractors, everything everybody else runs from, we gravitate for to. So basically, I would say, borrowing a phrase from an old friend of mine, I worked with at Fireman's Fund, you know, we talked a little bit about strategy when it came to the game of softball, and he looked at me and he said, well, the whole strategy is just hit it where they ain't. And that's pretty much what you do in the E&S world, is try to find something that nobody else is doing and exploit that. In addition to writing these other lines, we do specialty programs, and these are ones with sponsored by MGAs, and will involve some type of unique market niche, you know, whether it's restaurant, bar, and tavern, or a unique contracting risk written in a certain part of the country. And basically, some of these may have certain risk-sharing features that are very unique to that program. They may require separate reinsurance treaties. And that's, again, our specialty niche is putting together these specialty-type programs. Talk a little bit about the actuarial function over at Max Re. My company, prior to my arrival, it was a department of one. And joining there, we became a department of two most recently. We're now a department of three. And every time that you add it, when you grow that dynamically, I mean, you got to think we doubled our size and then, you know, again, another 50% growth in the department. It actually adds a lot of flavor to, you know, what items are you going to find to be most important to address. But you're also dealing with, you really don't have a whole lot of resources to address everything. Right now, I sit across from one other actuary. I don't know who does the most yelling, him or me, but every once in a while there's a little shouting going back and forth. He assumes the role primarily of doing the reserves, and I do the role of primarily looking at the pricing. Although there's no firm line, he does pricing on some of the accounts. I do get involved with all the quarterly reserve reviews. So we have basically shared responsibility for the actuarial function. Like I said, we get into both each other's business and provide peer review. If I do the pricing, he'll be doing the reserve work, those type of things. And, you know, being a small company and being two individuals, communication or having certain ways of communicating is not really a big deal when you have two actuaries. We've got the same training. We speak the same language. Well, he speaks more languages than I do, but we know what each other is talking about, and for the most part, it works really well for our internal communications. It typically gets a little bit more challenging when you're talking about outside management and bringing in those forces. So I'm going to move on to the differences in focus. Our department actually reports directly to the CFO, and so as you can imagine, the thing that he's most concerned with is going to be the overall loss reserves, and that tends to be the focus of our smaller department. And basically, when we talk about the differences between when I got my pricing hat on or my reserving hat on, is, you know, when I'm answering the question, basically, when I do a number of reserves, it's going to be how much should we post in liabilities. And when I do that, I have to worry about several different people. One of them sitting here next to me are external actuaries, as well as regulators, AM Best, reinsurers, IRS. Basically, when you're doing the reserve work, I look at it as being in a balancing act of basically seeing how far you can actually piss off the different groups before one of them yells at you. So, yeah, he made me take the word out, but I decided I'd just throw it back in there.
I encourage you to keep it in.
But anyways, again, the focus is more on what was. And so when we're looking at the data, you know, it's very important we keep everything in control of you know, SOX compliance, be 100%, know what data was there, have all the claims systems reporting into it. And on E&S, that actually is a little bit more challenging than a regular primary company because we don't have everything on our own system. Sometimes we're relying on the systems that the MGA has, and those come of various qualities, you might imagine. So we'll get to the pricing side. When I'm doing the pricing work, I'm with the underwriting department, which, you know, again, my number one person I report to is the CFO, but when you're doing the pricing work, you basically, you know, you got to get to bed with the underwriter, get to know what they're thinking, what they're trying to accomplish. I'm well aware, and I do say, you know, especially working with MGAs, and I actually get close enough where they can touch me every once in a while, it's really important that you keep some way of being objective so that you don't fall into that rose-colored glasses syndrome. And start drinking the Kool-Aid or whatever else you want to say about that. But, you know, in a small company setting, you don't have the advantages of being in an ivory tower at all. You're basically going to be affected by the salespeople that come into your office. That being said, that's why a lot of times we, you know, try to keep a little bit of a Chinese wall. Harry hopefully forgives me for using that term because I don't know where that actually came from. And he's from China, so. But we try to keep a little bit of a wall between the reserving and pricing functions. And when I'm doing the pricing, again, I'm concerned with the underwriters. I'm trying to keep the producer happy. I'm trying to keep the underwriter happy. I'm trying to help us achieve our goals on production. And you know, the other major concern that we deal with is trying to make sure that we have appropriate price change monitors. And on the E&S side, again, that ends up being somewhat more problematic in that, and you'll hear from underwriters all the times, you know what, we're not ISO, we don't have to report the stats, we can do whatever we want. And my job half the time seems to be trying to convince them that if I have a structure over here and we all understand it, I can help you manage your business better. And a lot of times, it ends up being one of those things where it takes a while before you can get them kind of more comfortable that you're not there to try to overburden them with a bunch of structure, but you're trying to help them so that you have a better idea of how they stack up to competitors and that type of stuff. But the other thing too is when I'm doing pricing, major difference between doing the reserve is I want to ask the question of what will be. Where are we going? How's this book going to be different than what we had previously? Not going to say that. There are times, you know, when you're doing, you know, forecast. If you know that you've jettisoned a certain type of business, or you've restructured, changed a policy form, and in our case, in the E&S side, that happens quite a bit, where, you know, we're all of a sudden here, you know, have run into a certain problem. and we'll actually change the policy form. And as the actuary doing the pricing, I will immediately try to enact that. Then we sit there and watch it on the reserving side to make sure it actually worked out the way we want it. And again, you know, E&S side, you're primarily going to be dealing with a lot of long-tail casualty, so it's always problematic on how much of your judgment you're going to give to any of these changes. And we're talking about, you know, changes to language as far as how to handle contractor risk. And you'll have an underwriter come up to you and say, well, based off of this, we'll never get another one of those construction defect claims. And you'll be kind of shaking your head, well, don't know about that. I really won't be able to answer that question for probably another 8 to 11 years. But you basically have to figure out, you know, how to adjust for what they're telling you. Talk a little bit about the differences in the data that is used for pricing and reserving. We got a colleague here that I used to work with at another E&S carrier. And the time when I was there, primarily what we worked on was trying to develop one data source. You know, we had this whole fantasy world that eventually we'll all get our data from the same place, we'll be able to hit a button and it'll reconfigure it from profit center to annual statement line and everything will work out just perfect. But we actually got pretty close. I was pretty satisfied with what we were able to do. But when you're doing reserving work, you really are kind of constrained on the data that you're using. You got to be, you know, listening to your internal auditor, you know, trying to make sure you have all the right SOX controls in place. If you change your methodology or say, well, you know, I got to break out this business from everything else, you got to basically explain it and re-explain it and you go through management and then external actuaries and then maybe state regulators. So a lot of times on the reserving side, it's really difficult to get the momentum to make major changes or make them very fast. The other thing too, on the reserving side as opposed to the pricing side, especially on a smaller E&S company, well, this probably goes for any large company, there's always significant amount of reinsurance typically placed on that business. And so sometimes management will get more focused on net company results and kind of get their eye off the ball on what's happening with the direct business. And although, you know, you can think that direct flows in, affects net, it ends up being one of these things where, you know, as an actuary, you'll find yourself kind of challenged a little bit of trying to get them to pull out and look at the bigger picture on a direct basis as opposed to what's happening just a net of reinsurance. Okay. On pricing side, I would say on there, I end up digging through a whole bunch of different stuff. Pricing on the E&S side, again, we have programs coming in from MGAs. A lot of times I'm dealing with data that's not in our system, that's furnished from other outside sources. You may know a few of those yourself. Basically you basically take all these divergent sources, try to fit them in together, do your pricing analysis as best you can, understand a little bit about, you know, how it was priced, how it was worked up. Typically, you know, with the programs, we'll be looking at, you know, limiting losses, smooth over the results. We're not necessarily looking at anything net to gross because the prior net gross are usually with another company, so you don't really care about that. And then the other thing that typically goes with looking at large accounts and any bit people that price large accounts or do consulting work for self-insured, you know, you're going to look over the data, you're going to have to make some adjustments for those, you know, large losses that'll never happen again and things of that nature. Again, it ends up being you're modifying a stated set of data and trying to fit the world that you see for this program in the future. And that could be basically limitations on some of the business that was represented in the data set that you have and trying to figure out what type of real adjustments you can make to it. So that you are reflecting the book going forward. Talk about a little bit about the interdependencies of data coming from the reserving side to the pricing side. You know, on the reserving side, we spend a lot more time dealing with the claims people, talking to the various people in claims management, trying to get an idea what they're doing, what they're seeing, what type of issues they've discovered on coverages. And they usually are giving us the information at the same time they're giving it to the underwriters, so the underwriters have a chance to proactively make changes to the policy to fix some of these things if they can. We look at loss development trends. Basically, you know, again, being a small company, you can imagine you have a lot more fluctuation in your staffing. And so trying to figure out, like, when one claims manager started or left, becomes something you have to really pay attention for in your data. Looking at average severity trends, and basically, again, these are something we rely heavily on the pricing side, so that we can, you know, make some adjustments. Again, working for a small company, a lot of times your own data is not really that valuable for determining some of these parameters for pricing risk. But it's important to kind of look through what you do have. Talk about a little bit about, you know, passing back information regarding mass tort issues. For us, you can see construction, you can imagine what we're faced with and what we have to explain to everybody regarding construction defect issues. So basically, it's always really important to know what your claims people are doing and what the reserving actuary is thinking is going on with your mass tort issues. And like I said before, claims department changes. Smaller company is, the more dramatic small changes can be, and it doesn't even have to happen at the top. It can happen down a little lower than that. So I'm always on the ball, having to interview and re-interview and ask the same questions to the same group of people, hopefully, year in, year out. Oops. Let's see if I can go back. There we go. That was just one or two? Oh, page up?
Yeah.
Okay. Basically, then we've got information that flows from the pricing work that we do to reserving. That's primarily going to be related to the current loss ratio projections that we have by line of business and by program. Pricing actuary is also in charge at our company doing some of the reinsurance modeling, basically recognizing mix of business changes, both for the pricing side and this primarily would go into the planning and over to the reserve people. I also provide typically to our reserving actuary information on the price change history so he can modify his Bornhuetter-Ferguson techniques. And run those to the model. And also, you know, again, this is kind of redundant. It's basically, you know, he'll hear about coverage changes directly from the claims people. I'll hear about the same coverage changes from the underwriting. They basically contrast notes and try to figure out what we think may be happening with that. One of the things, you know, I know the title of this presentation was Integrated Pricing and Reserving Functions, Talking to the Other Actuaries. To me, one of the major challenges, especially with a small company, is not the communication between the actuaries, but between you and the management, and that's the underwriting management and the CFO, typically. And when you're doing pricing and reserving work, as far as actuaries go, we're very comfortable. We all have the same school of learning. You know, when we're talking about loss ratios, we typically know what we're talking about. But just some topic is like loss ratios. I worked at one large company, I'll remain nameless, Mark, but you may know about it. But when I first got there, one of the things that came to me was there was like five different reports for the profit center that had loss ratios, and they were all different. Every single one of them was different. And when I had to go investigate what they were, you know, it found out that, well, somebody, you know, this one was put together by finance, and it defines incurred losses as including IBNR, and it tied to the book numbers. and it was allocated from home office and pushed down. Then we had another one over here that was actually provided from a regional office and was done from the actuary doing the pricing work and was pushed up. And then we had issues with whether it included ULAE or if it was net and gross of reinsurance. And these type of things, we take for granted, we can easily explain that. We put those things, little titles or whatever, and then we throw them out to basically a manager who's maybe not all that comfortable with all the different language. Maybe their background wasn't PC insurance the whole time during their career. They may be from banking or something like that. They look at it, all they see is the word loss ratio, and they figure, if this is loss ratio for this line of business, it should be the same. You go, oh, no, that's calendar year. You're thinking calendar accident year. And those type of things are fun for us actuaries. It makes it look really smart. But for management, it's just frustrating. And I think we all have to kind of be well aware of that. And don't be smug or cutesy a lot of times with the fact that you may know and your other actuaries may know what you're talking about. But basically, you're selling your services to that other guy who doesn't understand. And so it's very important, I think, you know, as an actuary, looking at these two functions is to be well aware when we have differences, things that could be apparent discrepancies, and be ready to explain those to management and help them to understand. And it's not always easy. That's often the hard part, is maybe considered the soft part, but it's the hard part of being an actuary, of being an effective actuary at a company. And the other thing I say here is just learn to be considerate to the other person's audience. As a pricing actuary, you may be able to respond a lot quicker to changes that are being made. Please realize, on the reserving side, you know, they may not be able to quickly figure out how to react to good news or bad news on a particular line of business as it pushes its way through the results of the company. So it's really important that, you know, you kind of consider yourselves a team and work together to make sure that you can communicate effectively to management, especially at the times when you may end up, you know, showing numbers that seem to be a little bit at odds. And for me, you know, I could tell you it's like dealing with the fact that I came into the company and, again, a small company, and the focus on management was primarily on net results. And I come in and I'm doing all my pricing work, and I'm all focused on direct business. And when I showed them my numbers, they didn't know what planet I was coming from. And it just was a matter of time to kind of walk them through and make them comfortable that I wasn't changing everything on them, that I was looking at it slightly different and presenting it differently than what they had seen it before. Oops. Well, let me go back one. Well, let's see if I can do this real quick. All right, whoop, now we went back to the, let me go back to the last slide real quick here, page down. Just wrap up, again, what I consider to be the important considerations. Number one is communication. Make sure that you're always sharing your information. If you learn something on reserving, and share it with the pricing actuary or vice versa. Know the differences between what's going on with the pricing analysis and the reserve. It's important for inside the actuarial department that you do stay on top of that. You know, the last thing management wants, because I promise you, if they're doing their job, they're going to come back and ask the reserving actuary what they think where something is going. So make sure that you're sharing your work across the fence. And leave it so that, you know, identify clearly, you know, when you have differences of opinion. And because that often is really hard sometimes for management to understand. A lot of times they're going to expect that the actuaries come up with a number. And then when your two actuaries come into the meeting and we both have different numbers, and it's based primarily on what issues of the analysis we gave more weight to. It's important as the, you know, from the actuarial department, make sure that you're going to communicate those effectively so management understands what the disagreement is on an actuarial basis and not that one actuary is right and one actuary is wrong. And the last thing I put down here is just know your limitations. You're never going to be able to you know, please all the audiences or be able to translate something that's found out on the reserving side to the pricing side, vice versa. But with that, I guess I'll turn it back over to Greg. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Mark? Yes.
Say that one more time.
What kind of controls do you have in place to make sure the information is shared on a regular basis, and would that change for a large insurance company versus small?
Yeah. I would say because of the proximity of me and the other actuary and the fact that I think we have a very good relationship, you know, I also make the time, you know, make sure that we go out to lunch once a week, but pretty much we're working together every single day. So we don't really have a formal communication circle like what, you know, we showed from Michael's group, because it is just the two of us and we're building the foundation. As we move ahead, we are trying to figure out how to build the best structure. We just got another gentleman to join in the group. And again, now we've got to modify exactly how we're separating duties and stuff like that. So it is always kind of, especially small company, you can always think that every 6 months you're going to be redirecting, you know, how the department's going to grow, you know, how best to fit the strengths of the people that you have. You know, if one of us were to leave, the structure would have to totally change on who's doing what part of the analysis and things like that. But for the most part, I think, you know, the vision right now is in place that we have one person primarily responsible for the reserving work, one person primarily responsible for the pricing work, and just having that peer review, that process. So, you know, like you know, I've worked at larger companies and it's a lot more, has to become a lot more formal. And you're gonna have, you know, information going up, you know, from the pricing actuaries to the corporate, and corporate feeding things down. And I've been in that environment as well. So, and again, I think size is going to dictate exactly how much formal structure you put into it. So there's another question over here. What type of data differences, or? I don't know, how did we fight it out? Steve and I used to work together, and actually at the company we worked at, we were kept pretty much arm's length from each other. We didn't have a lot of interaction back and forth. I did primarily the pricing stuff, and I was with the reinsurers reinsurers, and also with the underwriters, so I got a lot more partying than he did. He had to basically sit there and do most of the reserve work. I looked, you know, there was some challenges trying to make sure things were communicated back and forth. I think for the most part, the biggest thing was on the E&F side, a lot of times the systems that are there to capture the data for the minimum reporting requirements for financial reports. And as a pricing actuary, you go in there and go, God, you know, I really want to know how the underwriter is thinking when he's pricing these things. I really got to get those, you know, criteria. So on the pricing side, when I was there, I was pretty much looking at what are the systems the underwriters are using, or how are they pricing this stuff out? Let me get a copy of that. Is there a way I can get the data fed in, and then I can supplement it to this financial data I have? And basically, I always felt like my job was more to add and supplement the data that was already there. I wasn't creating new stuff. I was just basically kind of trying to devise ways of adding information that wasn't necessarily on the back end system back to it, so that we could basically do more robust analysis. Any other questions?
How
Is this on? Yeah. From a reinsurance perspective, we are in different departments. I don't know that we ever completely had the same picture of how any given deal is going to perform. I think there is a very high level of objectivity coming from both sides. At the end of the day, I have to sign off on the reserves and make sure they're adequate and hopefully make sure that they're consistent and we got the right number. So we are going back down to the actual underlying data and looking at it maybe from two different perspectives. So I don't know if that answers your question, again, from a reinsurance perspective of how we keep objectivity, but you know, it helps if you don't really like the pricing actuaries either, so you don't feel compelled to come up with the same answer. Oh, this is being recorded. I forgot.
I guess on the objectivity, you know, dealing with the differences that I've had, you know, I would say being the chief actuary, you get to be the judge and jury and make your decision kind of stick when there is a difference of opinion. I actually, you know, try to solicit that on a regular basis from the guy that I'm working with, because I hate the thought that if I make my decision up and I don't have somebody to cross check it and challenge me, I'm eventually gonna miss something. And so if we don't have any conflict, I feel like probably I'm teamed up with the wrong actuary. I like to have somebody who's gonna be a little judgmental or think we should be doing it a little differently. Because it's the only way I think that you're gonna learn. And at the same time too, it is one of those things, you know, most of the time I get to win at this point, but you know, that's I think part of the whole, you know, why you have structure in your department and have a chief actuary, because that's where the buck has to stop. But if a chief actuary's got everybody who's just saying yes to him all the time, he's got a problem. I'll start with that. A lot of times, the differences will be, I'll tell you, this is one that came up recently. I actually seen it a couple times happen. Company I was working for, maybe it's the most recent one I worked for, ventured into contractors in New York. Got a really bad taste in its mouth and quit, okay? Now, on a reserving side, those claims are gonna pile up and show up there, and they weren't in there for the price, you know, for the pricing. The pricing actuary did get it wrong back then, and you're going to have to live with those results on the reserve side. So you always got the management looking at the calendar year loss ratio going, oh, this is terrible, and you're trying to say, oh, but over here on the pricing side, we got it fixed, because on a calendar accident year basis or a policy year basis, you know, this, we've basically got this in line with our profit targets. That's a scenario that often exists and has to be explained. And when you've got both the pricing and reserving actuary there working together, you can pull that information out and throw it right in front of them and have them go, oh, now I understand. And so, yeah.
Other questions? This is the part of the program where the different teams now come into play, and we know it's late and you probably are about ready to bolt for a drink, but one of the things that I think you hear that is threaded through all of these comments is the communication, and I think there are challenges to have communication and the proper feedback loops between actuaries and the pricing and reserving functions. It's also critical, kind of going back to something that Don Mango mentioned in the general session this morning, if you're going to successfully underwrite a line of business or a reinsurance contract or a program, to have that feedback loop where everybody is privy to the information and gets to see the whole circuit is very critical. And we're kind of focusing mostly on actuaries today, but even more importantly, and also more of a challenge sometimes, is to work with the other departments. And you've heard both Mike and Mark talk about the importance of understanding how the claims department operates, the underwriters. And so it's a challenge to do that, but if you don't do that, number one, you're wasting information and you're not being as efficient as you could be. And number two, you won't be optimizing your underwriting results, because without that kind of a loop, it just isn't going to work. And other than that, we heard a lot of differences, and I think probably every situation is different from every other ones, because different people react in different ways to things. There's different territorial leanings and things like that. One of the things we thought might be interesting, if anyone out there has something they would share, maybe the way their situation works or a situation they're aware of, whether it's the same as these or different, or any other general comments that in your experience would be helpful to others in kind of dealing with this communication issue. Any comments or any anecdotal stories anyone would like to offer? Yes. Thank you. Anyone from Team B? Yes, ma'am. Anyone else? Okay, then. Well, I'd like to thank you for attending the session. Could we thank the panelists one more time? Thanks a lot. Enjoy the rest of the day.